was a litigation fight. A fully packed room, Kev Dog is here to crush. Ready to entomb some defense MD. His opinion's all junk, he knows he can't hide. Scared to the bone, just hit the west side of Hermosa Beach. Defense about to learn, wrath of SLG. Send the Army report, opinions all weak. All you insurance doc hacks are about to see.
All right, so that was Regulators by Kevin O'Hara. It's a beautiful rendition of a beautiful, beautiful ballad. It was actually a perfect iambic pentameter. So with that, I'm going to turn to our poet. I think Kyle Schneeberg. So Kyle and I went to law school together, beautiful Pepperdine. Also, so did Sean O'Neill, another one of our panelists today. And Carla, she went to Southwestern. It's where my twin brother went, so whatever. But Kyle and I were in the same section. I sat in the back and scribbled a notebook, and he sat up front like a total noob, right? Paid attention. So I guess that's why he does these complex areas of law. So Kyle, tell us a little bit about your practice, where you are. You know, I know you as a specialist in the elder abuse cases, the managed care facility cases. So introduce yourself and tell our listeners how they can find you.
Thank you, Bob. So my name's Kyle Schneeberg. My firm is the easy to spell Schneeberg Law, PC, S-C-H-N-E-B-E-R-G. I practice out of Torrance, and I went out on my own about 3 years ago. So I was with firms before that. You want me to say more about where I've been?
We've heard enough from you, actually. You're off the rest of the show. So Kyle was one of the founding members of Justice HQ, as is Sean O'Neill. Carla's a member as well. You know, we do a lot of things together in teams. I think I've worked with all of you in some form or fashion, a lot of different cases. But Kyle, give us you had experience. I think you and Carla both worked. Did you work together at the firm in Long Beach doing elder abuse cases?
Carl and I, that's how we met. We worked at an elder abuse firm together.
All right. And Carla, how was it like? What was it like working with Kyle? Was it everything you dreamed about?
You know, they gave him quite the intro before he actually made his appearance in the hallways of the famed firm. And I can remember thinking like, oh, they're going to put him, you know, we were actually neighbors, office neighbors. And, you know, the first morning he shows up and he's like ready to work. And so I show up and I did my famous thing, which actually turned into a pattern, a daily, like, poke my head in, hey, how's it going? And we really became great friends. He's amazing to work with. I mean, we're all going to give him a lot of heat today, I can tell, but he's amazing to work with, super passionate. And, you know, I think we both grew a lot in our time working together at that firm. And then we both kind of just decided it was time to fly solo.
Yeah. And you have the Carla Law Firm, you know, solo practitioner, crushing it as well. And you also had the time and energy to run for a political position.
I did. Apparently not enough time or energy because I did lose. But hey, I think I get a participation award. I haven't received it in the mail yet. I'm sure it's coming. No, it was a really good experience. Yeah.
You might want to look into those votes. I heard many were fraudulent. I voted zero times. So I apologize.
That's word on the street. Yeah.
So, Carla, I don't know if everybody here is a pure blood, but you were at Lewis Brisbois for 2 years or a year and a couple of months.
Those were some of my darkest moments. I kid. I'm half serious. You know, it was a really interesting experience for me because I think I went into it like, I'm going to give this a real chance. And let me tell you, when your heart is in plaintiff's work, you realize right away that you're in the wrong place when you're on the defense side of the V. But it was really good experience because there's nothing like being one of them, you know, when it comes to wanting to learn how they operate. I call them theys. And so now that I'm back on the right side, the bright side, I look back to those things that I learned and that insight that I got, and it's invaluable. I love that I did it. It was not a fun time, but I love that I did it. I think it gives me an edge.
It's actually, you know, in our firm, we actually, the partners and I, we joke that the best education, if we want an associate to hire, we almost want him to go through like a 2-year apprenticeship at a defense firm. Like, get on the line, grind, learn, see how it's done.
Yeah.
Appreciate life, right?
Yeah.
So how many elder abuse cases do you think that you've handled over your career, soup to nuts?
Me?
Yeah. We'll start with you, and then we'll go to Kyle, then we'll go to our anchor man.
You know, I think that when I was at the firm that Kyle and I met at, I think I had a load at one point of about 20 to 25 cases that was kind of assigned to me. I was an associate. I was just a mere mortal. Still am. I'm trying to reach my godly status. But at that time, I was even more of a mere mortal. And, you know, those cases I worked with the partners on, but I would say about 20 to 25 at a time when I was there. And then when I was at Lewis Brisbois, I handled them, as I said, on the other side. And that was honestly the way they handled their case assignment. It was hundreds at a time.
Yeah, we're going to talk about handling stuff from the defense perspective a little bit at the time you were there, so we could discuss it. So last and certainly least, or not least, sorry, Sean.
Definitely least.
So we have Sean O'Neill here, and you know, Sean, another elder abuse expert, managed care facility experts. He also does a lot of medical malpractice cases, as does Kyle. So you know, Sean's with the Stalwart Law Group, another founding member of Justice HQ. Sean has some roots or had some ties to Pittsburgh, my hometown, so that makes him an okay guy. He also has an O with an apostrophe name of a big Irish guy. So, you know, Sean, thanks for coming on. Why don't you give us a little bit of insight into, you know, what these cases are like handling now? Because our listeners, we're in 2021, we're talking about, we hear nursing home cases, we hear COVID contractions in nursing homes. So give us a little bit of the landscape of what you're dealing with now, a lot of stuff that you hear.
Yeah, well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on. You know, these cases are so fact specific. And I know a lot of people hear COVID and what's going on. Are we taking COVID contraction cases? You know, in the news, most of the deaths we were seeing early on were happening, unfortunately, in these nursing homes and assisted living communities. And personally, I'm not taking COVID contraction cases right now, except for I do think COVID plays a tremendous role in how I evaluate my cases. So if it's a fall case, a bed sore case, an infection case, you know, whatever the general types of cases that we accept, I think COVID, the analysis of COVID is going to be the overarching theme, right? The families aren't in there. The regulators aren't in there. The staffing is down. And if the facility has a high COVID rate and they're accepting new residents, which is we see happening, and they're not addressing for that, you know, COVID becomes the reason why this neglect is happening. So I'm not taking COVID per se cases, contractions, except for the analysis on COVID is certainly playing a part in these cases in 2020 and into 2021.
Yeah. So Kyle, whenever, you know, and we've worked on some cases together where y'all get a call and say, hey, as soon as I hear nursing home or managed care, I just say, call Kyle, call Sean, call Carla, right? So a lot of people hear these cases and they think it's medical malpractice cases. How are you able to differentiate elder abuse to medical malpractice, and what is the difference and how do we plead it?
You know, the reality is if it weren't for MICRA and just how abysmal that is for consumers in the state since, 1975, I don't even think elder abuse would exist. I mean, elder abuse is a way to get accountability for victims of the way this industry unfortunately tends to run. What we're looking for are systemic violations, specifically what we call recklessness, where there are choices made at the management level that these managers, managing agents, they know that people are likely going to have severe injuries due to the way that the facility is being run.
So what is, Carla, if you had to define what is elder abuse? Because a lot of our listeners practice different things. We have a large following from law school. What is, if you had to define it, what is elder abuse?
You know, if I had to just kind of put it in a nutshell, I would say that it's a systemic failure to do their job. And by their job, I mean the people that are getting paid to look after and care for people that are in a very sensitive state, whether they be, you know, sick or physically, you know, disabled. And there are lots of obligations, and we could sit here all day and go through, you know, nitpick through all the things that these facilities and these managed care places have to follow. And unfortunately, there are millions of examples of the kinds of things that they actually don't do. And so that's when we start looking at, it's a pattern of neglect, you know, a failure to make sure somebody's taking their medication, a failure to protect them from getting these bed sores, pressure sores, ulcer sores, whatever you want to call them, patterns of dehydration, you know, infections that are contracted from somebody who is also sick, where they fail to protect other residents from contracting the same infection, UTIs from improper hygiene. You know, these people are often relying on their caretakers to provide them with not only the tools, but the procedure, actually, you know, bathing them to keep them clean and to keep, you know, proper hygiene. And a failure to do that leads to things like UTIs and pressure sores. And so, you know, in a nutshell, it's a failure to abide by the rules that they're required to follow when they're caring for these elderly people.
So, Sean, when we have these cases, who's the actual defendant? Is it the doctor that's making the prescriptions for these things, the people taking care? Like, how is this not medical malpractice?
Yeah, so we want to, so MICRA is always looming its head in nursing home cases. So the first thing is it a nursing home or assisted living community is the first, I guess, analysis you have to determine. Assisted living facilities by statute are non-medical, so MICRA doesn't apply. That's negligence and then potentially neglect.
Well, how do you know that? How do you know that? Like, you just look it up?
Yeah, so nursing homes are licensed by the California Department of Public Health. Assisted living communities are licensed by the Department of Social Services. I mean, the most simple way I can explain it is an assisted living community generally will say assisted living or senior living in the name. Nursing home will generally say rehabilitation, convalescent home, nursing center. A nursing home has a physician generally overseeing your care and 24-hour nursing cares, RNs, LVNs, CNAs. And in the assisted living communities, you have caregivers. They're non-medically trained. You might have an LVN in there, but you know, you have little houses, little six, what they call six packs boarding care facilities, or they have the bigger, you know, Brookdales and communities like that, where there's hundreds of beds and you see those commercials, and those are private pay generally. And in the nursing homes, it's generally Medicare and Medi-Cal that is paying for the care. And those are medical facilities. So that's the first step in the analysis. And who we're suing is, if in the nursing home, you really have to understand how these organizations are set up. And generally, you know, it's kind of like a criminal enterprise. The good guys who make a lot of money doing this, they set up management companies, supply companies, real estate companies, and they set up this little poor, you know, nursing home. And they, what that same company, there's one owner generally owns all those companies and siphons money out of that nursing home to benefit the owner at the expense of the American taxpayer and the population that we represent, which is why we see these injuries, which is why Carla and Kyle keep saying these are systemic in nature, that they know what they're doing is setting up the residents to fail. They know that their staff isn't trained. They know that they can't meet the acuity needs of the residents, but they keep the staffing the same and keep accepting more people, and at the same time charge themselves management fees, siphon the money out. So in order to get the real remedies, you have to sue everybody, unfortunately. There's a guy who will remain unnamed, Shlomo, who's really good at this and has in every company we have, every time we sue one of his entities, it's like 10 different defendants. Otherwise, there's really no threat of punitive damages because the nursing home shows a loss. We lost $100,000 last year.
Kyle, I want to ask you this question. So, like, how's it like peeling back that onion? It looks like we're playing a shell game. I mean, this is the banana republic, like, what's going on? So when you're filing a lawsuit and you're doing that pleading, how many defendants are there? How many causes of action? How do you plead MICRA, which is the medical, you know, medical malpractice lawsuit, in the alternative? Just walk our listeners and viewers through that.
So let's talk about the causes of action. Often the victims have passed, which is common. You know, often people who are in a nursing facility are there because they've had a condition or something they need to recover from. So we do plead wrongful death. The law is a little unclear whether that's going to be a negligence cause of action or not. So we do typically plead negligence standard or wrongful death in addition to the elder abuse, which is a much higher standard of clear and convincing proof. The shell games are real. They're very savvy. Fortunately, there's still a lot of public information available to us to find out which companies are involved with the enterprise. It's not always 100% accurate. But I will tell you, I did defense work in the beginning of my career. In fact, one of our clients was the largest chain in California, a chain that, no surprise, went bankrupt around after I was involved in 2015. Labor code violations, tax violations, like 40 personal injury, elder abuse lawsuits. So they went under. But I also worked for a chain back east. And what became very apparent to me and was shocking is that there is a very consistent model, and it's a sophisticated model, but there's a very sophisticated model that has been consistent throughout the nation. That, I mean, I at one point I was wondering, is there like a, you know, running a nursing home for dummies handbook that was being passed around, and they were all doing the same things and violating the rights of these patients?
Carly, is there a handbook for dummies that was not discoverable in your times at Lewis Brisbois?
You know what? If there was, they hid it from me. I have yet to lay eyes on it, but I agree with Kyle. I mean, it's shocking. You know, you sit at these depositions and you're asking, you know, whether it be like the, you know, maybe the charge nurse who's heavily involved with the client, and you're asking questions and they almost answer the same way. It's like, if there's not a how to run a nursing home for dummies, there's like how to, you know, answer at your deposition in an elder abuse case for dummies too, because Kyle's not kidding. I mean, these are sophisticated schemes. I like to call them schemes, and it's the epitome of the profits over people model.
Wow.
It's all about, can you shave off, you know, can you maybe send that CNA home early a couple hours to save in that way? Can you, you know, instead of hiring somebody who's qualified, can you hire somebody who maybe has, you know, proven that they, you know, maybe they've been fired from a bunch of places and you can pay them less. And that all translates into the quality of care that these victims are getting.
Wow. So, I mean, when you're sitting on the defense side of these things, and for, you know, the plaintiff side, it seems like pleading heavy from the beginning. I mean, are you seeing a lot of motions to dismiss or demurs and a lot of motions for summary judgment to get these entities out? I mean, how do you deal with it? Like, it seems like it takes months even to get your case at issue.
You know, it was actually really, really, I don't think I've ever had one of these complaints where I filed and they just answer. Typically, you know, you're getting your motions to strike, you're getting your demurs. And again, there's a pattern there. And I think, and Kyle probably, he's like kind of smiling because I think he knows where I'm going, but a lot of judges, you know, you'll get before them and you're arguing, you're opposing the demur, and they sit there and they're like, well, why is this not micro? And there's this like weird sort of obsession from a judicial front to kind of treat these cases like they're med mal cases. And so when you're us, you know, when you're the Seans, the Kyles, the Carlos of the world, you have to actually sit there and just continually repeat, listen, this is not a med mal case. And here's why. Here's the difference. Here's why it should be treated differently. And I think that if you fight hard enough, you know, a lot of judges, even the ones that are inclined to think otherwise, you can kind of convince them. But it does take some, you know, you have to grind at it because it's really common. And some of these defense lawyers, they're relying on that. You know, they're relying on this idea, this notion that judges are going to look at the case and go, oh, you know, I see it. I see Dr. you know, Smith referenced here. Why isn't this med mal? And so they're sitting there going, yes, 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 you know, rubbing their little evil little hands together going, I hope this works. And so I think for us, it's our job to kind of bypass that tactic and draw attention to the fact that, no, this is not a med mal case.
Kyle, why is it not med mal?
So there are several decisions in the history since the 90s, and the major issues are, was there a custodial relationship? We've seen that become more important in the last 5 years. For example, if you go to your primary because, you know, your neck's sore, there's no custodial relationship there. You go to his office and then you're out. The other issue that is I think is pretty common knowledge, but maybe it isn't, that MICRA controls the provision of professional services and essentially a breach of the standard of care. And so what elder abuse, we stand on the shoulders of giants in this industry because they have carved out a jurisprudence that really helps people. And what they did 20 years ago is they argued that just as an intentional act in the context of a medical procedure is not controlled by MICRA, neither is recklessness or elder abuse, that it's something else, it's something different. And that's how we get accountability against these people beyond that 250 general damages limit.
And Sean, so is there a time limit for somebody to be under managed care or in a nursing facility or in a that type of, I mean, can it be 1 day, 10 days, 2 months? I mean, is there a difference? Does it make a difference?
Yes, everything's fact dependent, like Kyle just said. And these cases are neglect cases, right? So if you're only pleading negligence, you're going to lose. It's MICRA 10 times out of 10. And the legislator gave us a carve out for neglect. There's a 2-year statute of limitations, but as it relates to when custodial care kicks in and when you can plead a elder abuse neglect case, if something terrible happens within a day, and they had care and custody over you, you were admitted to their 24-hour facility, they were responsible for your activities of daily living, then yeah, you can plead elder abuse. I mean, if your mom is sent to a place, she has dementia and she can't be around certain things, or she's a fall risk, mm-hmm. and they just decide to leave her in a room, do nothing, and she ends up falling and dying, that's elder neglect in my opinion. So there's no bright line test except for they have to be admitted to your care and custody. Mm-hmm. That's the test. Whether or not the facts arise to neglect is a factual determination, which is how we beat these demurs and motions to strikes and motions for summary judgment.
So Kyle, you and I think are both 40. Are we old enough to be elder abuse victims? What's the cutoff?
We are not. You got to be 65, man. We've got time. We can't be officially elder abused yet. What we do look for is if somebody is in a custodial care situation, if they're between 18 and 64, they may be considered a dependent adult, mm-hmm. which again is a factual determination.
Well, what's a dependent adult?
Well, a lot of times in custodial care, we're seeing a lot of dependence for activities of daily living, things like eating, personal hygiene, anything you may do during the day. It may be as simple as transferring from the bed to a chair. So if you fall while playing softball this year, Bob, and break your hip, you go into a hospital, and even though you're only 40, you know, you can't get from that bed to the chair too easily. So you'd probably be dependent at that point.
Right. So it's the same statute, Bob. So the elder abuse statute is elder and dependent adult abuse. So it's the same analysis for neglect. If you're admitted to a facility because you have a mental disorder or a physical injury that you're rehabilitating, the same statute applies. If you're dependent on somebody, you know, for your activities of daily living, that same analysis applies. And if you're injured, you can plead an elder abuse or dependent adult abuse neglect cause of action.
So Sean, I'm seeing on your screen, you have the Stalwart Law Group behind you. I thought you were Justice HQ. Did you just claim those offices as yours and put up your signage?
I do officially, I'm the unofficial mayor of the Justice HQ Orange County office as I'm the only person who comes here.
That election must have been rigged too. I didn't get to vote for that.
It was rigged. There was no voting. It was a singular vote.
And you're a dictator.
I am at the I'm at this office, but I was told to put up a background.
Well, it looks good. So we established how old you have to be. How long is all factual, stuff like that. So Sean, can you give the listeners, we're gonna go through across the board, people that are listening, your contact information, your best email address, and let us know the statute that you're referring to, because a lot of people don't practice this area law. They might be interested in learning about it just for some nuts and bolts.
So I can be contacted at Sean, S-E-A-N, at Stalwart, S-T-A-L-W-A-R-T, law.com. I'll give you my cell phone. You can call me on my cell phone anytime. I'm normally at this Justice HQ office in Orange County working out of here. My cell phone is area code 760-212-5122. If you want to look up the statute, it's the Welfare and Institutions Code. I think it starts at 15630. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's the Welfare and Institutions Code. It's the Elder and Dependent Adult Civil Protection Act is what it's called. And that lays out, that's the entire statute. And the statute's a great place to start to determine if this is what you have in your, you know, in your firm is an elder abuse case or not. And if you can't decide, call me.
Carla, can you give the listeners your contact information? You don't have to give your cell. Sean's pretty bold here.
I'm not going to give my cell. I'm kidding. My name's Carla Waymire, as Bob, you so kindly mentioned earlier. You can reach me at carla@thecarlafirm.com. It's with a K, as you can see. Oh, wrong side. It's with a K, not a C. All the greatest Carlas in the world start with a K. But you can also reach me at the office at 213-377-9177. I'd be happy to just chat and, you know, we can talk about what your potential options are. Absolutely. But if you have somebody that, you know, you love or you know that's been hurt in one of these places, you really do kind of have to go through the analysis, and it is fact specific. So it can't hurt to talk to somebody who kind of knows and understands these claims to help you sort through it all.
And Carla, before we switch to lowercase K, Kyle here, we're going to talk. I want to ask you, if you're on putting your defense cap on for 1 second, if you wanted to get a case, say Sean files for elder abuse under the statute, he said, and you want to get it into medical malpractice, as a defense lawyer, what do you do?
If it's like in an elder, you know, elder home or something like that, in a nursing facility, you really kind of have to hang your hat, I think, on two things. You'd have to argue that, you know, they weren't admitted, it wasn't custodial, because that's a huge, huge aspect of it. I found what they do is they emphasize the medical care. So they'll talk a lot about, you know, well, doctor so-and-so is who you refer to in your complaint, doctor this, doctor that. And they'll say, you know, how is this not med mal? How is this not the fault of that physician as opposed to the facility?
Yeah. And Kyle, can you start by giving us your contact information? Kyle's our scholar here, who's like, he can spit out a treatise if he wanted to, or a comic book, I don't know. But Kyle, can you give us your contact information for our listeners?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's my email is kyle@schneeberglaw.com. That's S-C-H-N, like November, E, B as in boy, E-R-G, as in George. I know, I should have had a better name for attorney contact, but it's what God gave me. And my cell, texting is always a great way to get a hold of me, 310-699-3745.
Yeah. So Kyle, whenever we're prosecuting these cases, it seems like it's pretty lawyer heavy on writing the pleadings, defeating these demurs, these motions for summary judgment. But what does it cost as far as getting experts on board, liability experts? Who do you have to hire? You know, when we're taking on these cases, what does it look like from that perspective?
It's very expensive. And the longer the case goes on, the more expensive it gets. One of the great things about elder abuse is the remedies do include the right to attorney's fees and costs if you prove your case. Mm-hmm. And defense they're concerned about that. The challenge in elder abuse is that no two cases are necessarily alike. We're dealing with fragile individuals who have very different comorbidities from case to case. So you may need a venous expert in one case. You may need a wound care expert in a different case. Mm-hmm. You may need a nursing expert. You may need an administrator expert. So you never know. But typically, we see 3 to 4 experts on these cases, and it's a lot of back and forth.
And what is the most critical? I assume whenever you're trying to pin down the violations of the managed care, depositions are critical. So what are the most critical depositions and how do you game plan for them?
I think what you really want to look for is making sure you have the full medical record. I don't think I've ever seen a case where we get the full medical record up front, even when we're told it's the full medical record. It's never complete. As a former defense attorney, I can tell you there were times where I went into the facilities as a defense attorney, asked for the record, was told they'd have it ready in 3 or 4 hours while they went and found the missing pages that should be in there. They got signatures on the pages that weren't signed.
It's funny, but it's
gnarly. I think you want to, an attorney wants to look for the medical records, and you want to look for policies and procedures, mm-hmm. and then you want to start digging up the dirt in these cases. The real challenge in elder abuse is that it's not quite as straightforward as some other areas of injury law. In elder abuse, you can have multiple injuries, medical, physical injuries, and if a facility met the standard of care and did everything right, there may not be a case. On the other hand, you can have one fall and have an elder abuse case if the elements.
Yeah, and Sean, have you ever seen any instances where somebody was signing the wrong medical records? You ever bust somebody for doing something like that? And I see you laughing. Do these things happen, and how do you let it play out?
Oh yeah, my rule when I take an elder abuse case is, first of all, I never file a case obviously without reviewing the records, but I get 2, 3, 4, 5 sets, and I label them as, you know, first set, second set, third set, depending on what part of the case we get them. For an example, recently, I think this is why discovery and kind of knowing how the system works is so essential to prosecuting these cases successfully. But just a recent example, we had a case, we got brought in, and I could tell just by looking at the records that they were fraudulent. They had been changed because the time, you know, they said this woman came in with a wound on the admitting paperwork. And then for 4 days, it said she had no wound. And then it said she had a wound and then disappeared again. And then it came back. And they just did a really sloppy job of covering up this woman's 11 wounds, 6 of which went to her bone and ended up killing her. So I got the audit trail from the electronic medical records company. I subpoenaed the records. And in the audit trail, you could see that after the lawsuit was even filed, that they were altering and changing mm-hmm. records to say that this woman had a wound yeah. when she was admitted. And once the defense lawyer saw that, the case went from 200,000, we did nothing wrong, to please take the policy. So understanding how these cases work, how the electronic medical records work, and doing a really thorough job on discovery is really essential to being successful in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Carla, correct me if I'm wrong, but the more I hear you guys talk, the more it's these cases are won in the trenches. They're won in discovery. They're won in taking the depositions. If a case goes to trial, I mean, it seems like you guys are just, you know, shooting a shotgun into a barrel. I don't even know how that expression goes, but it sounds like it's pretty, you know, but if you get there and the juror's going to be pissed off. But I mean, what Sean just said, it seems like this is where rubber meets the road. So how much time are you putting into these cases?
A tremendous amount of time. I mean, and Kyle's nodding, Sean's nodding. Really quickly, so Sean mentioned something that reminds me of one. This is probably the moment that I learned how much time goes into these cases. I have a habit, and I learned this when I was working kind of with Kyle. I have a habit of requesting anything that's handwritten in color. And the reason for that is I had a case where there were, you know, daily logs, times Mrs. Smith was checked by, you know, certain nurse or whatever. And over the course of 9 months, the log was filled out in the same pen. And, you know, those are the little things that it's hard to believe. I mean, I lose my pens, and I have pens that I love that I guard kind of almost like too much. So how do you keep your pen for 2 years, right? And so these are the little nuances. When you want to talk about in the trenches and hitting, you know, the road with the rubber, you've got to be paying attention to the tiny little details. Discovery is key. Paying attention to detail is key. You have to sit there and comb through the material that they're giving you. And it's, Sean was so dead on. They'll tell you these are the records one day, and then turn their cheek, you know, next week and tell you, no, these are the records. And there are things in there that weren't in the first set, or vice versa. And so it just goes down to this, it's their method. It's part of their business model.
When you say you get things in color, what do you mean by that?
Oh, literally request things in color. Or, you know, when you do your production request, instead of saying, you know, just slap me with your, you know, 5,000 pages of whatever it is you're going to send me in a box, I would like to come in and physically look at the file, and I'd like to see the paper. And, you know, it can be sneaky, but really effective to say, send me your pile first, and it's all in black and white. And then when you see a document, you're like, how can this be? You can go in and say, now I want to see, I'd like to see the file in color. And that's when, you know, the same purple glitter pen was used to check on the same patient for an entire year. You start to wonder, you know, that's either the most important pen in the world, or something's going on here, and that log was filled out after the fact. And so these are the little things that you can grab onto and kind of run with that add a tremendous amount of value to the case.
Kyle, how often are you hiring investigators and looking at things that the defense doesn't give you in discovery?
You know, I haven't gone that route, and I've thought about tracking down the former employees. So far, most of the time, the depositions of the often they'll represent formers. In fact, I had a defense attorney tell a judge in a discovery conference a year ago that they weren't producing the names of formers because they wanted to contact them and represent them first, which I thought was pretty stunning ethical violation.
Yeah.
I haven't gone that route yet. It adds expense to an already expensive case. But what I find is you get 5 or 6 depositions and you don't even need it. All the evidence you need is already there.
Yeah.
And Shauner, I mean, you're suing these same companies that are playing the shell game. I mean, do you ever just use the deposition of the PMK you took 2 years ago, get it into your case in chief? And if so, how do you do that?
Yeah, good point with the management companies. I mean, there are big chains, repeat offenders, as I call them, that, you know, that come into our office. And we certainly using a PMK depo is a great way to tie them down again to the violations. Also, you know, in the nursing home context, like I said earlier, these entities are licensed and regulated by the Department of Public Health. And they have investigators that go out and do investigations on violations of, federal and state law. And those are also great. Past violations are great tools to use in your depositions to show that they had this knowing pattern of violating residents' rights. And they did nothing about it, even though they said to the state, you know, here's the training we're going to do. Here's the actions we're going to take to make sure this doesn't happen again in the future. And then it happens to your client. So, you know, getting all that information, prior citations, prior lawsuits, employment lawsuits, a lot of these people, these poor CNAs, they're set up to fail, right? They get 20 patients or 20 residents to take care of. And these people need a lot of care and they don't get additional help. And a lot of times they don't even get paid for the work that they're doing. So I look for prior lawsuits, prior citations, former employees, workers' compensation lawsuits. That's a gold mine of witnesses to get you to that clear and convincing reckless standard that you need to get to.
Yeah, and for the clear and convincing reckless standard, you're talking about getting punitives.
Right. So the real, you know, I guess meat and potatoes here is the threat of punitive damages and attorney's fees, where you don't have that in a micro case. And that's why, you know, there's this area of law existed, because if micro was controlling these cases, nobody would do it. And which is one of the injustices of micro. And so in order to get to that, you know, those damages, you have to get clear and convincing evidence of reckless neglect. And actually to get the punitives, you have to get malice, oppression, or fraud. So these cases are so discovery intensive, and it has to be ratified by a managing agent. I mean, you have to really know what you're doing and get those depots locked in and this is why most of these cases don't get tried, honestly, because there's that threat of big damages. I think last year, Ed Dudensing up in Sacramento got a $44 million verdict. And if you do your job and really, really hammer these people in discovery, they understand that there's a real risk. And then there's a real risk on our side, too, if our client dies, you know, we don't get that management company tied in. That's the company with real money. So a lot of these cases they settle.
Yeah, and that $40 million verdict, that was the next floor up in Sacramento trying a case at the same time. And, you know, Sacramento's known as, and I think it's getting more, you know, plaintiff friendly, but it's a more conservative venue in California when you see these huge verdicts coming out here. So we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to pivot right to that. I'm going to start with Kyle. Kyle, why is your 85-year-old client's case worth the 7 or 8 figures that you're claiming it to be?
Because I think juries care about the elderly. You know, they don't want elderly people being abused, especially when a business, a national business, has promised to provide the best care. And they say, you know, one of the places I go to are the websites. You go on there, we'll provide your loved one the best care in the world. And then you find out it's almost the worst care. Juries don't like that, and they don't like being tricked and betrayed by companies that are good at marketing, and they get angry. Juries will get angry. And when they see, I mean, if we had time to go into all the things we've seen, all these betrayals in the care that's being provided and how it's just killed people, When juries see that, they add a lot of zeros to that verdict form.
Yeah, Carla, we see all three of you getting 7-8-figure results on these cases. I'm asking you as defense lawyer, you're telling me that your 85-year-old that was suffering for a month due to these bed sores is worth $5 million. Why?
As a defense attorney?
No, I'm asking you.
You're the defense attorney. Yeah. Good. I was like, stop putting me in that role, please.
It's weird because I'm a pure blood. I've never been on that side. You and Kyle, you know.
I also did defense work, so don't exclude me.
Oh God, reptilians. All right, Carla, why? Tell me why.
You know, Kyle hit the nail on the head. Listen, these are arguably some of the most vulnerable people in our population. Everybody had at some point or has a grandparent, people you love. And families are relying on these people to take care of their loved ones. And when their loved ones are in those places, you're relying on strangers and they're being paid to do their job. And when I think juries get really, really, really pissed off when they see intentional, attempts to hide things, for example, intentional, for example, lying, where one employee comes and says, you know what, I'm tired of this. I'm going to speak up and I'm going to say what really happened. That's your smoking gun. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does because these cases go to the heart. And I think it really pisses off. It's like, you don't mess with children, you don't mess with animals, and you don't mess with the elderly. These are people that they're relying on others to be okay. And that's why these cases can be so, so powerful in a jury setting, because it's a human. It goes straight to the heart, straight to the heart.
Yeah. And Sean, Sean's actually been published in a peer-reviewed article about talking about damages and proving damages for the elderly that have pre-existing medical conditions. And, you know, email Sean, text Sean, call Sean to be able to share that article with you, because, you know, we're out of time. And if you have any questions, it's media@justiceteam.com. or Robert@the Simon Law Group or Robert@justiceteam.com. You can text me too at 310-564-8981. Thank you everybody for coming on this episode of the Justice Team Podcast.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having us.
So I took the report and went right through it. I grabbed the mic and said, let's do this. You seen the MRIs and said nothing's up. Yet I know lying is how you make your bucks. This doc is a sleaze and also a perv. Straight face at the disc, never hit the nerve. Forget the treating docs, this a classic trick. Paid to say the disc is normal and shouldn't be fixed. I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I need to expose this crooked doctor's wealth. Insurance every time, surely the next. Paid millions to lie about injuries of either sex. No evidence of that, it's going real swell. KC3927 Eggshell.